Welcome to Give Theory a Chance. In this episode, we are joined by Dr. Amanda McMillan-Lecue, Associate Professor of Sociology at Drexel University and author of Who We Are Is Where We Are, Making Home in the American Rust Belt. Amanda returns to the podcast to discuss foundational humanistic geographer Yifu Tuan and his influence on her own research and theorizing. Hi, Amanda. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We are here today to talk about Yifu Tuan, and I should say I'm particularly excited about this one. You know how people do those family trees? So technically, Yifu Tuan is my grandfather. I went to Minnesota to work with Karen Till, and Karen Till, I believe, was Yifu Tuan's last PhD student. So I have these roots for me, and it's kind of like reminding me of my history.
It came to mind whenever I was reading more about Yifu Tuan's legacies, and Karen Till popped up. She wrote a really nice memorial paragraph about her experiences with him. He passed away in 2022, quite retired and living a very full life. And so it's been neat to be able to trace some of his intellectual legacies, particularly in geography, but certainly in sociology as well. So yeah, I'm excited to talk to him about it.
Yeah, let's get into that. So first, can you give a short introduction to who he was or what he's known for? And then I want to talk more about that intellectual location and whether he's made it into sociology and how.
Yeah, sure thing. So we're talking about Yifu Tuan, who was born in China and immigrated with his family to the U.S., I believe in the 1940s, and made his career here. He actually got his PhD in hard physical sciences, like in geology, but then very quickly began to write prolifically. He wrote maybe 20 books in the area of what became known as humanistic geography. So in short, he created the field of sense of place, this approach to human geography that's attuned to structural and relationship components of human-environment relationships. And this was really unique because he was directly countering the quantitative revolution of the 1960s and 70s, the same quantitative revolution that we're very familiar with in sociology. And so Yifu Tuan created his own space in the field of geography to call attention to places not just as sites or locations of social or historical events, but rather places as kind of characters in their own stories, in our stories. He really wanted us to pay attention to the whole of the human experience. And he wrote these series of remarkable books speaking of space, of place, of topophilia, of place attachment, of the ways that humans interact in place and how the stories we tell about our places reflect our own social and cultural positions, but then also are shaping the places and our mobility and interactions within them. So this, I think today, so much of studies on place, both in geography and across the social sciences, takes many of these concepts for granted. But really, one person was responsible for creating the intellectual playground for us to explore new ways of thinking about the human experience in a landscape, in place, the ways that our emotions, our sense of self, our communities intersect with the places that we call home or that we call work or that we leave and enter back into. So Yifu Tuan was very influential in the fields, particularly in geography, because that's where he called home. He was at University of Wisconsin-Madison for decades after moving around some. But also he did come to shape other fields, and we can talk about that soon as well. He really shaped the way that I think about a lot of questions about place and home as well.
I'm glad you pointed out that he started as more of a traditional physical geographer, because so many of the geographers of the 60s and 70s, even someone like David Harvey, who's one of the most famous Marxists, he had that same start in doing that more place-based statistical analysis. And then they had to push and say, hey, there's something else that we can pay attention to. But you can see how they carry, like Yifu Tuan carries that appreciation of the physical landscape over, which I think is really important.
That's such a great point. And I think that's in all of Yifu Tuan's writings, which are very theoretical. They are beautifully written, easily accessible, but heavily theoretical pieces. He's still so attuned to landscapes. So his earliest papers were on the geomorphology of the American West, so deserts. And he was fascinated with this physical reality. But I can see why he quickly started linking our experiences in that physical reality with the broader field of geography, because I think we can't talk about the physicality without talking about our experiences as people. And yet, as social scientists, again, like you were saying, we tend to focus so much on our experiences that people sometimes we lose the physicality of the landscape itself, the nature, the built environment. So he brings these two fields together really nicely through all of his work.
That approach has a strength because it can bring together. It's not that he didn't focus on the power of capitalism, what it did to these spaces or how it created place. And it's not that he didn't focus on the physical landscape. And it's not that he didn't focus on humans and agency and decision-making. It allows him to exist at the intersection of all those different mm-hmm. forces in a way that's sometimes lost.
Something I really value about the way he writes about human experiences of place is he speaks of our experiences as humans as a whole, instead of compartmentalizing and segmenting off certain structural components or economic components or the role of capital. It's part of some of his analysis, and we can come back to this a little bit more from a sociological perspective in a little bit. But I think there's such a value to the way he steps back and thinks, I think, sociologically about how the structures and the physical geography are part and parcel of the phenomenological experience of being human in a certain place. Now, there are limitations to that approach, for sure. He doesn't pull apart certain intersectional issues of inequality, for instance. That's what I think where sociologists can really contribute something. But often I think that we compartmentalize so much that we kind of lose this big picture perspective of what does it mean to be human in a really challenging world, in a place marked by a lot of mobility. And I think he speaks to that really well.
Yeah, and his style of writing is so fascinating because I think Karen Till told me this, that he always told her, you should write for that first or second year undergraduate student who's really excited. And that's the level. But he's also writing. So he's writing the words themselves and the sentences make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But he's also an incredibly abstract theorist at the same time. So it's combining these. And I can't think of other academics who really write in that same manner. And the first time I was exposed to his work was as an undergrad who was a major. I had a double major in geography and philosophy, but it was traditional analytic philosophy. And in geography, it was very much that traditional study of the landscape. Mm-hmm. And the first time I read his stuff, I wasn't ready for it. And I was like, I don't know what this is. This doesn't seem like science. It doesn't seem like building the argument in the way that philosophy taught me. And so I wrote this really critical paper about him. And then I went off to Minnesota and studied with Karen Till, and he was the most exciting, inspiring person that I was reading. Instead of first time, I was like, oh, this isn't what an academic is supposed to do.
Absolutely. So let me tell you the story of my first interaction with him. I was fishing around. I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. My advisor, Michael Bell, who joked with some seriousness that we should have been geographers, him and me, because of the types of questions that I was asking about human experience of place related to residential stability and environmental economic change. So he was sending me actually over to do an independent study with a geographer in the Wisconsin department, Keith Woodward, who's still there today. So I was wandering around Science Hall, which is where the geography department is located, and saw a sign for a final lecture for Yifu Tuan, who was retiring around that time. And he called it his farewell lecture. So I attended. And I remember the same experience. He was speaking in such an easy to understand way about the things in the human experience that were fundamentally true, that it did not feel like we were in a lecture hall.
Yeah.
In one of the best social science departments in the U.S. with who I came quickly to realize was one of the leaders of the field. I think so often we think accessibility means it's not mature thinking, and ergo, inaccessibility or complex thought means that, this is something new and exciting. And I think that Tuan's easy to read, just everyday language, where all of his words and sentences were very clearly chosen, but moving coherently and consistently through a logical thought process, it just was such a refreshing way to think about social theory for me, because he was able to speak to what's true. And that's ultimately, I think, what academia, what scholarship is trying to do in the social sciences. We're trying to name patterns that we're seeing in the world in a way that is true while still providing some bigger insight so we can learn something about our experience as we move forward in life. And he did that beautifully in this final lecture. So that's what drew me into his writing more broadly. And that writing became a bit of a model for how I wanted to do social theory. And I honestly kind of critique other social theory based on how accessible or inaccessible it is to the way that, you know, everyday people can think through this.
Yeah, he shows it's possible.
Right.
So do you get a sense that outside of your advisor who's saying that you and him should both be geographers, do you get a sense that his name is known in sociology? Because clearly some of his ideas, as you were saying, have slowly, I guess, through osmosis and often being neighbors in big universities, kind of shifted over and spread. But do people know his work in sociology? Are people reading him?
That's a great question. And I was doing some quick searches to try to see in publications how much he's cited. I think something that's tricky about Tuan is he has shaped an entire way of thinking.
Yeah.
But his work, it was never citation heavy. His work didn't actually cite that many people. He reflected on his intellectual journey occasionally, but because his work was so distinctive and created its own space for thinking about space and place, I think that he's not as well cited as some other scholars of place might be across disciplinary boundaries. That said, people do know who he is. So in environmental sociology and rural sociology, which are two of my main subfields, I can see his direct influence. People who study place attachments, I'm thinking here of Richard Stedman and others in the United States who have made a career of looking at human relationship to place, often through survey instruments. He is certainly, Sedman and others in the place attachment U.S. field have been certainly influenced by Yifu Tuan's framework. I mean, beyond sociology, social psychology, I'm thinking here like Maria Lowicka, who also is an internationally well-known place attachment theorist, is so influenced by Tuan, as well as human geography. Human geographers who maybe are actually more directly cited by sociology. So here I'm thinking of Tim Cresswell, Karen Till.
Yeah.
These are folks who I know are directly influencing some of the younger scholars in my field of environmental sociology or community studies in rural sociology. So I think maybe his influence is diffuse, but his ideas have permeated sociological thinking about space and place. I think we need more of it. To be honest, in sociology, we need more of this interactional thinking, phenomenological thinking of what place means in social science research and sociology specifically. But I think it's his ideas have already really shaped the way that a new generation of scholars in sociology thinks about these questions.
So after you saw him give his lecture, one of the challenges we sometimes have is when there's courses not offered on particular ideas or figures, you have to go off and read it on your own. So was that the path that you took? You saw his lecture and then you went and tracked down some of his writings and it was kind of an independent journey?
Yes, it was an independent journey. It helped again that my advisor, Michael Bell at Wisconsin, who has been for his life very interested in questions of place, guided me through that journey with certain reading selections and through my independent study with the geographers at Wisconsin, I was able to read both Tuan and some of the people who had been influenced by Tuan to see what I was looking for, especially as a grad student, was how theories of space and place, of topophilia, this attachment to landscape, how do we actually analytically study them? Because Tuan is a theorist, and I needed models of how people took some of those questions and ideas of what does home mean to people whenever home is changing? That's a question that was really important to me. Or when landscapes are in crisis, how are people looking at that and asking that as an empirical question rather than just creating the space to ask those questions in a more philosophical sense, which is what Tuan did. So I spent a lot of time reading people who were pursuing some of those questions empirically, many of whom were in the field of geography, but some of whom were also in sociology. So like Mario Small, had some work and his new project is also doing this along those lines. Some excellent environmental and rural sociologists like David Pello or Shannon Elizabeth Bell or Hilary Angelo are asking similar questions in sociology more broadly. And so that's kind of how my intellectual journey went. I was inspired by this theorist and this way of asking questions. And then I looked for models to empirically answer those questions on the ground.
Yeah. And that's one of the challenges. It's a strength and weakness of sociology is that we're very data driven, and geography is a little bit more open to do that experimental, abstract theorizing or engagement with the world. And so as a sociologist drawing on those ideas, you do have to convince other sociologists that it's something that we can measure and test to some degree.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Was there a particular idea that you found intellectually inspiring and has influenced you moving forward?
Yeah. So I was, from the very beginning of my graduate career, very interested in the concept of home. And I realized quickly that in sociology and often in broader social science, any empirical or theoretical work related to that word home tended to focus on inequalities within the domestic sphere, which are important, but that wasn't the way I was approaching this question. I was thinking of home as more of this claim to space, claim to place, and site of constant negotiations in the face of change. And that definition, my definition, I started to see flagged in Tuan's work. Yeah. So there was this relatively obscure article of his from 1971 that I stumbled on called Geography, Phenomenology, and the Study of Human Nature. And in that article, he talks about home as a site from which we venture forth and to which we withdraw. So this idea of kind of tides ebbing and flowing, that conceptual binary, that contradiction was really helpful for me as I began my research on post-industrial communities, sites that are often considered homes to leave because there's nothing left, so kind of publicly construed. And it helped me think about the contradictions between the rootedness and fixedness imagined at home and the openness, the flexibility of beyond those walls, beyond an established community. It helped me to start asking questions about mobility and movement related to stability, perceived stability at home, in a way that wasn't, again, so compartmentalized. So in sociology, we have amazing scholarship on mobility and migration. And really, in the past 10 years since I started my research, there's been even more amazing work coming out on migration as related to people who do not migrate, out-migrate. And thus, because they're not out-migrating, they need to renegotiate the places that they're staying in. But particularly a decade ago, that was a harder question to ask in a sociological sense. So Tuan's ideas of home and house as a place from which we go to venture into the world and then retreat into opened up a new set of questions and a way of helping me bring ideas of movement and change into a intellectual space that had traditionally been relegated to like stable, stuck language.
Okay, that's a perfect place to transition into talking even more specifically about your book. So your book came out, Who We Are Is Where We Are, Making Home in the American Rust Belt, which I very much enjoyed reading, even though before we started recording, I told you I was reading it through the fog of COVID, but even then I still enjoyed it. And you only cited Tuan twice, and the citation was the quote that you just gave, but I felt like his presence was everywhere in the book. And for me, I know there's one of the compliments of the book is you could read it in lots of different ways, but for me, it was it was a book about home. And I love that you shifted, instead of saying, why aren't people leaving? Like, what's wrong with these people or what's the barriers to leaving? And that being the central question. That's what we often ask about areas that are struggling economically is like, oh, you know, those people could leave. And if they don't, it just means they can't. And instead, you shifted it to being like, well, what does it mean to stay? Not treating people like they are just mistaken in the choice, but not over-romanticizing them as saying, well, they're staying because they're fighting to do this thing. And it's like, what is this connection? Mm-hmm. So I know I just said a lot and it wasn't really a question, but I'm wondering if you could talk just a little bit about your book and maybe introduce the project and then think through how Tuan's ideas were there and tell me if I'm wrong in saying that this really was a book about home.
You're completely right. The book was about home, and I'm so pleased that you saw that. I did many revisions for that first chapter to make sure that that was a framework that I contribute.
And I think that quote was in the first few pages, right? And you,
yes.
And, yeah, and you also start with a quote from a geographer before that. So you have it there, even though you don't always constantly return and be like, this is what I'm doing.
Yes. Any book writers out there will know the tension between wanting to pay homage to the most influential scholars who shape the way you think, while also presenting your own data in a way that is coherent and consistent with your own approach. And so I'm so pleased that you saw the way that Tuan has shaped my work, along with many other human geographers, because I did try to be judicious in the ways that I cited directly scholars. But let me share a little bit about the book project more broadly for those who haven't read the book. So this book, Who We Are Is Where We Are, Making Home in the American Rust Belt, emerged from my PhD research in two communities in the American Midwest. So I did qualitative research, interviews, archival research, and ethnography in Iron County, Wisconsin, which is a very remote rural county next to Lake Superior, northern Wisconsin, next to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, population around 6,000, used to be an iron mining community. They lost the iron mines in the second half of the 20th century. This is not just a story, though, about rural poverty or economic loss. I also included a case in southeast side of Chicago, an urban neighborhood on the border with Gary, Indiana, that used to be the steel mill manufacturing site, the hub for steel in the city of Chicago. And these two communities were connected through the iron and steel commodity chain. Iron from Iron County, along with neighboring mining communities, was shipped to the southeast side of Chicago in the early 20th century, along with other manufacturing sites, of course. What I wanted to do with this comparative rural-urban study was think about not boom and bust, though that's certainly part of the story, but I wanted to think about the long aftermath of deindustrialization, particularly in the wake of 2016 election, the kind of a renewed academic concern with parts of the white working class rural America. I wanted to pay attention to these two communities and the people who lived long-term after deindustrialization. So I studied and interviewed long-term residents, people who had lived through boom and bust, who had lived in these communities for multiple decades, who made these places their home long-term, even when, I mean, these two communities have been in economic depression and crisis essentially nonstop for almost five decades. These are objectively hard places to live. Yeah. And I wanted to ask questions about how and why do they stay in these communities, and how does staying, the act of staying, the strategies involved in staying, actively shape or resist some of the infrastructural constraints of a post-industrial community? Because we know a lot about how being in an economically depressed place kind of reproduces economic depression. I wanted to understand both how that structural functions, but then also how the people who stay are engaging with those structural limitations as well. So fundamentally, it's a story about home. It's a story about how people who have lived in the same place for a long time make sense of change, strategize, and make ends meet, and shape the stories they tell both about themselves and about the places that they call home, even decades after the economic raison d'etre has shut down. So that's the book. And Yifu Tuan's work influenced this book in a couple key ways. So first, and I already mentioned this about his framework of home, that couple sentences that really sparked a way of thinking. He really helped me interpret certain aspects of residential persistence because, for instance, I found in both rural and urban cases, home ownership was a key reason why people stayed. Yeah. They were able to buy houses in the mid-20th century because wages were good and house prices were reasonable. Their companies shut down, and either they decided to stay and pay off the mortgage, or their house was already bought free and clear, and they realized that it didn't really make economic sense to move to a new place. Now, a sociological approach might pause there and say, this is an economically rational decision. And yes, maybe it was. But this isn't the story fully that interviewees told. And I wanted to step back and honor this sense of ambivalence, maybe some ambiguity in the narratives people were telling about what home ownership meant to them. I realized through interpreting, spending some time with these interviewees, that houses were certainly a material sink. There were economic reasons that were very important to why they maintained their home ownership. But also, they would often say things like, yes, we bought the house, that's why we stayed. And I know the neighborhood. I like the neighborhood. Or we bought the house, we paid it off, needs some repairs. But if you leave, that's how you kill a neighborhood. There's often these second phrases that focused my attention to how the houses themselves, the physical houses, were places from which residents could venture forth to riff on Tuan and to which they could return. In the midst of tremendous change, the houses provided some sense of stability and a place from which they could observe and interact with their changing world. So I think that Tuan's framework helped me pause and think about what could be ostensibly considered just an economic rationale in a more complete and human sense. Like, what else is going on here?
Yeah, it gives them agency. It's constrained agency, but it gives them some sort of agency because they understand the economic forces and they understand the process. And it's not simply this helplessness of like, well, we can't do this thing. We want to, but we can't. There's something else. There's something more there. So that's one of the things I really liked about what you were doing.
Yeah. And that's well summarized, like well put. Often I think we think if it's constrained agency, it's not agency, but that's not actually how we as people function. Like you and I make decisions all the time in constrained situations. Like given X, we only have a couple options, Y, Z, and we will make those decisions. And in that decision-making is still an element of agency that is important to us as individuals. Who likes framing themselves constantly as helpless? Very few of us would want to do that. So I think that in making these, you know, providing these secondary clauses about the material constraints of homeownership, but then also what else they homeownership provided, my interviewees were able to cling onto a little bit of really important decision-making power. And they wanted to direct my attention to that as well.
Yeah. And some of the people, I mean, as an outside reader, if you're not aware of these communities and you're simply driven by this understanding of decision-making is based on economic forces, a lot of the decisions won't make sense, right? It's even, you have stories when you're in these remote areas in northern Wisconsin, sometimes you're commuting hours and hours to work, or the commute is not a daily commute, but you know, a weekly commute. Mm-hmm. And reading it, you're saying, well, then why don't they just try to go to that space or do something that's easier? But you need that emotional aspect too to understand why. Again, it's not naive if people are aware, like, hey, that would make economic sense, but there's something that matters in the place that I'm leaving from.
Yeah, there is a sense of consistency in remaining in place in the midst of a crisis that is really important. And it's often is tangled up with economic rationales. Because maybe there's concerns about the expense of moving to a big city, you know, moving from an economically depressed rural community to Minneapolis, Minnesota, to in order to find a job. There are economic costs to that. And there are kinship ties also that play a role to tie people to certain places. But exactly, like I think if we do drive-by sociology, if we just quickly think, like drive through a community, southeast side of Chicago, rural Iron County, our instinct might be to think like, why don't just people up and leave? And while there might be economic reasons to move, there are many other, maybe ambivalent, maybe very positive reasons that people provide to stay behind as well.
Okay, so I interrupted you as you were going through. So that was the first way that Tuan influenced the book. What were the other ways that you were going to bring up?
Yeah, the other ways I think that Tuan influenced my work was because, as I mentioned a little earlier, he influenced other scholars who provided me models with how to actually measure and assess some of these more subjective experiences of place. He created the sense of place field, which is a very recognizable approach to doing certain social science research, particularly though for people who are interested in qualitative or phenomenological work. focused on human experiences and measuring affect, emotion, physical responses, and kind of discourse on the ground of people who are experiencing a place. And so I relied on Tuan, but I also relied a lot on people like Tim Cresswell, Karen Till, Rick Steadman, dozens of other place attachment adjacent people who helped guide the way that I thought about collective sense of place. I didn't want to fall too much into individualized language of psychology, nor did I want to become a sociology of the emotions scholar, though there's a real place for that. But rather, I wanted to approach this from a community studies perspective, thinking about how individuals kind of work together to tell stories about their place in the this context of significant landscape scale change. And in the process of telling those stories, the place shapes them and they shape the place as well. So I relied on a lot of other scholarly work to help build a design for this research.
This might relate to Yifu Tuan's influence. I'm not sure if it did, but I'm curious. I could see you writing this book, and I could even see you being pressured to write a book in a way that focuses very specifically on politics in rural white America and saying, I have insight into this, and everyone's really excited to try to understand these places after we have Trump win and then lose and then return. So this is this important thing to say, what are these experiences and why is it shifting how people will vote or what people are angry or not angry about? And that's in the book, but it's not the book. And I'm wondering if you got pressure to go that route, because whether from your advisors or whether from publishers or why you chose not to go that way.
That's a great question. And it's a question that I've gotten frequently about this book project, because it's located in Middle America. This is a study in a very rural, historically Republican community. Well, historically since the 1960s, as my Wisconsin interviewees often point out, honestly, mining and manufacturing communities in rural and urban America were Democrat, were blue for a very long time. It was only after deindustrialization, kind of Reaganism, as it approached Republican Party politics took over, that there was a shift. So it would make sense in some ways for me to tell that story. Quite simply, that wasn't the story I got from interviewees. I did this research from 2015, the bulk of it from 2015 to 2017, so around election time. And yet, when I talk to people in my interviews about what, not only about their personal histories, but what they dreamed for their future community, I always ended our interviews with an open-ended question about what next? What do you want for this place? Never. Maybe once did someone say we need a change in federal government policies.
Yeah.
They always pointed to local government and the role that local policies played on the ground for their economic development options, for environmental protection, particularly in Southeast Chicago, for building and maintaining infrastructure, particularly in northern Wisconsin, which is really remote and disconnected. Local government and state government played a much larger role in the imaginations of my interviewees then did federal politics. And so I realized I didn't have data to build a strong argument about populism or the white working class and their political position today. I did have data to speak to how local government, certainly that local government resources are shaped by federal government and by state government. So there's its interconnectedness. But I had data talk about how local government and those policies related to zoning, land use, visions of a city or a county for what a place is for directly impacted everyday people on the ground, long-term residents in these communities. And that's where I end the book. I spend time thinking about this with my interviewees' narratives, thinking about what would be the best future for these two communities economically and environmentally. And again and again, we just turn to how can local policies support the economies and environments in Iron County and southeast side of Chicago?
I don't know if it's because of Yifu Tuan, or at least it seems like it's because of this focus on home, that you can hold on to seemingly contradictory things at the same time. And I'm not sure if this makes sense, but I'm thinking about how when you talk to people in the town, you can recognize that there's both a frustration with the companies leaving, but also a celebration of what the companies did for the town and how people can talk about these companies, which we see as being destructive of the environment, as also protectors of the environment. And again, it's not that you're treating the people as naive, but it seems like your analysis and stories are always ground up and not top down. I don't know if that's making sense, but it seems connected to home.
Yes, I think this is a strength of qualitative research, is you are limited by what your interviewees talk about.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to stay attuned to the concerns that people had and the perspectives that they were offering me. Because stories people say, particularly to outsiders like me, people who are not directly from the community, the stories that people are telling are shaped to communicate something about their priorities and their values, their concerns about their worlds. So in both places, I found that stories about the past, stories about how companies took care of, at least for some time, the communities, how companies provided policies and infrastructures that city or county could not provide in a certain era. I think that those are really important for us to pay attention to as fellow outsiders to these communities. Because I think, you know, when there's discourses now about rural or urban communities wanting a new generation of company or capital involvement, at times people are picturing those kinds of companies that would actually take care of the community infrastructures. Now, that said, my interviewees were not naive. In both rural and urban cases, my interviewees expressed desire to have capital involvement in their communities, because that would lead to jobs, that would lead maybe to higher tax base so that the local government could take care of the crumbling sidewalks and roads. But in rural and urban settings, again and again, I heard from people an acceptance that companies today are kind of messed up, that these are not the good companies. These are not companies that have an interest in paternalistically maintaining their environment or repairing those roads themselves, but rather these are companies that are going to create a different kind of space, like a space of exploitation. So even in the rural community, and I think often we overlook this, people were pretty blunt in realizing when they had this realization, they're like, these are not the good companies that are going to come in and mine this community again. But we're not really sure what else we can do.
You've already done this a few times in the conversation, but I'm wondering if you want to highlight any other theorists that you found worked particularly well with Tuan's ideas or were very useful for you in crafting the book.
Great question. And I was reflecting on this. I pull from a lot of different literatures. The book, I'm an environmental sociologist, a rural sociologist by training. And so the book certainly is impacted by people like David Pellow, his approach to critical environmental justice, folks like Shannon and Elizabeth Bell or Richard York, they're environmental sociologists thinking about the human dimensions of mining and landscape exploitation. But yet I quote David Harvey a lot as well, and other economic sociologists or social theorists, because all of my landscape scale concerns for this place, for this space, post-industrial Midwest, these landscapes were made for economic reasons. Capital is incredibly powerful in this story. So economic sociology and social thought shows up pretty powerfully throughout. I found community studies, scholars like Mario Small, really helpful as well. And in mimicking this very holistic, humanistic approach that I was so attracted to in Yifu Tuan. So often I'll direct students to other examples, like Mario Small's example, or other community studies where you're really looking closely at how community works in order to understand something bigger about capital, about social relationships. So those are some theorists that I found particularly useful, or some scholars. There are some people who did research kind of in the region that I also really benefited from. Carita Brown wrote a book called Gone Home, focusing on African-American home communities in Appalachia. And she was one of the first people who had a published book with this concept of home so clearly laid out. So I learned a lot about how she wrote that piece up thinking about the holistic experience, again, of an entire community through boom and bust and a long life post-industrial in this region. So those are some theorists and some academics whose work were really powerful for me. There are also non-academics that I always like to point people to, like Terry Tempest Williams and other writers who write about human environmental issues, but focusing on people's phenomenological experiences on the ground in a memoir or in a nonfiction setting. And those approaches helped me keep in mind that I wanted to write a final book that was 85% accessible to the people I was interviewing. I wanted people to see the truth in what I was writing about their own experiences on the ground.
Okay, so you've definitely done a lot of this during our conversation, but I want to end with my favorite question, which is, imagine you're standing in front of all the sociologists, all the professors, all the grad students, all the undergraduates, and also even the general public, and you are making an argument for why we should engage with Yifu Tuan's work, why we should pick up one of the many books that he published,
that it's not a task written, at all.
What would you tell people?
It's pleasurable reading. And if our role as social scientists, as sociologists, is to seek out truth about the human experience, then Tuan is an excellent place to start, because we all live in a place. It doesn't matter if we mostly spend our days online or staring at a screen. When we get up and we go outside, we're in a physical place with its geographies, its landscapes, with our neighbors, with pollution, with social structures embedded in a specific geography. We need in sociology a more coherent way to think about place and space across our subdisciplines. We need this because all of our social experiences, even macroeconomic and transnational experiences, are embedded in place. Deindustrialization, boom and bust, so much of the research out there on the core macroeconomic transitions that are going to anchor my book are placeless. Just like these economic things changed, the tariffs changed, trade rules changed, politics and policy changed. There was a race to the bottom. Companies moved abroad or to the American South. And these are true statements, very useful statements. All of these things took place, literally took place, because capital makes place. Capital makes place. Capital can break place. And so in order for us to understand these macroeconomic or other large-scale processes, we need to have a conception of space and place. And that's where I think Yifu Tuan, with his incredibly accessible writing, can help us understand a little bit more.
That's a wonderful way to end. So thank you again for joining. This is your second time on the podcast. I'm sure I'll invite you back for third or fourth in the near future. But this is great. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. This has been a blast.
Appreciation goes to Jeffrey Gilbert for providing theme music, SUNY Brockport for providing financial support, and most importantly, on behalf of me, Kyle Green, thank you for giving theory a chance.